This episode is sponsored by Feather Snack. Okay, hold on, y'all. I have to tell you about something that my wife got us into and that my whole family is loving now. Brace yourselves. It's the Feather Snap Scout Smart Bird Feeder. Yes, I said bird feeder. This thing is so cool, and it offers a brand new way to connect with nature and learn about the birds right in your own backyard. Or, if you're like us, living in New York City, it's in your friend's backyard in the country, and you get to use the app connected to it to learn all the stuff. It's got this high-resolution camera that connects to an app, so you can check out a live stream from your feeder. You can take photos and videos of the birds that visit. You can ID the species using expert-trained AI, and you can earn badges along the way. You can even, y'all, learn fun facts about hundreds of species. For example, did you know that American crows can recognize and remember people's faces? And they can even teach their young who's a friend and who's a foe? I know that now, did you? Seriously, the Feather Snap Feeder is entertaining, it's educational, and it's just a whole bunch of fun for the whole family. Check them out today at feathersnapcam.com. That's feathersnapcam.com. All right, y'all. I just want to take a quick second to talk about our sponsor, Sunbasket. I don't know if you know this about me, but I am not a big fan of grocery shopping or meal planning or anything that goes along with any of that. But I do very much care about eating healthy. But when you don't like to grocery shop or plan meals, it is really hard to cook healthy dinners for your family. And that's where Sunbasket comes in. They're a team of dietitians and chefs that design wholesome, nutritious, and delicious meal kits delivered to your door. Each week, you can choose from a brand new selection of quick and easy meal kit recipes with a wide variety of dietary options, plus dozens of snacks, salads, breakfast items, and more. And you can pick and choose from recipe options like vegetarian, Mediterranean, carb conscious, the list goes on. We just had orzo bowls with broccoli, sun-dried tomatoes, and pea stew, and it was delicious. My kids even liked them. I can't speak to Sunbasket more. I love them. Thanks to Sunbasket's commitments to clean ingredients and organic fresh produce, there's no easier way to eat your very, very best. You just have to go to sunbasket.com/queerfam today to save $120 across your first four deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/queerfam to save $120, y'all, across your first four deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order. Go do that. Get some healthy food. There you go.
Love is love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love.
Hello, 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 all you gorgeous souls, you. Welcome to another day of bonus episodes with the Queer Family Podcast and me, your host, Jamie Kelton. That was a mouthful, huh? Here I am in your ears again. You're getting me a lot these 2 weeks, and I hope you're happy about it. What you might not know, if you haven't been listening, is that I have been releasing bonus archived episodes the past week and a half to gear up for our season 11 season premiere, which drops next Monday, February 6th. So get ready, mark your calendars. New episodes are coming at you for season freaking 11, almost 200 freaking episodes. And you know what's funny? The episode I'm bringing you today, we recorded it years ago. It's from season 5, but it was when we were about to hit our 100th episode, and now we're about to hit our 200th episode, and I'm bringing them back. It's so cool. And one more thing, item of business, before I get to our guests that I'm reintroducing to you today, we have a new website. You're going to all want to go to thequeerfamilypodcast.com and check out the new, updated, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful website that was put together by my friends at Soul Camp Creative. Thank you so much. Check it out. Share it. Join the mailing list. Share it with your friends. Share it with everybody you know. Why the hell not? Just share it all over the place. I love it. It looks great. So go check that out. And now, let me tell you about Amanda and Gab. This episode is from season 5. It's episode 29. We were in the heart of the lockdown. We were in that pandemic. The episode was titled Fight the Power. And these two individuals that we interviewed, I can't even handle the awesomeness of them, the badassery, if you will. Let me just read you the description. Amanda and Gab experienced very serious microaggressions at the clinic where they were trying to make a family. Instead of suing, they worked hand in hand with the clinic to improve all aspects of how they interact with the LGBTQ population. Like, they took this clinic, they washed, wrenched, and spun it into a whole new clinic that was inclusive. I just remember sitting there in this interview, and we talked for a long time with them because it was just so intriguing. I just remember sitting there, and Robin was sitting there too. We were both just like in awe of everything Amanda and Gab did to make this clinic better for folks like them, for folks like us. It's just freaking beautiful. And during the time that we interviewed them, they were also still very much in the midst of their trying to conceive process. And things were not going great. Hadn't been going great. They still weren't going great. And they were kind of in a place where they weren't sure how they were going to move forward, if they were going to move forward. And it was just a really beautiful and candid conversation about it. And I learned a lot, and I think you're going to learn some more too. I just learned a lot re-listening to it. I had forgotten so much. So get yourselves reacquainted with Amanda and Gab, because they're going to be coming back for season 11 to help me with some interviews. And I can't wait. I can't wait to see what's happening in their lives right now. I can't wait to see how that making a family journey went for them. I think there's a child in the picture, but I'm not sure. We'll let you know. Just a little teaser for you. All right. I'm going to have Helen, my BFF now. Helen is so kind to me, and Beulah as well, since they've found each other and they know I'm all alone in my co-hosting world. But I'm going to have them roll the tape. Helen and Beulah, could you please roll that tape, my lovelies? Roll it. Roll it.
Love is love is love is love.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp and the new podcast, We Are Family. We're happy to have them both on board, making this show a possibility for sure.
Welcome to If These Ovaries Could Talk. I'm Jamie.
I'm Robin.
And we're your hosts.
We sure are.
Love is love. If you don't have to make a family by taking a traditional ride. If these ovaries could talk, you would say.
How do I get the sperm through custom?
I am a lesbian.
So gay.
We need to tell our story.
It's not your nuclear family anymore. It's not just your mom and dad thing.
We're not ruining these little humans.
Not for the gay reason. Just because we stay.
Hi there.
Hi, everybody.
Nice to see you here, be there for whatever. We're nice to have you here with us
on
again.
On our final episode of season 5.
Oh, that's so sad to say.
I shouldn't have said season 5 to see if you knew what season it was.
I don't know what season we're in, Robin. We've done almost 100 episodes.
Almost. This is 92.
That is crazy.
In the smack dab in the fall, we're going to have our 100th episode, which I'm really looking forward to.
Really?
Yeah, it's going to be a retrospective.
But if you count all our live streams that we do now and all that, we have
100,000. 100,000. So many. We're on the air everywhere, even though no one wants us to be.
Nobody asked us.
It's
nobody
true.
Asked to see our faces.
They really
not a
didn't.
Single person. But
they really
here we
didn't.
Are out there, right there for you to see if you so choose.
So we should tell people we're going to be off the month of August.
Yes, we're taking a little break. Just
oh my
a little
God.
One.
It's not a huge break, but it is. It was going to be just 3 weeks, but then I called Jamie. It was just like, listen to me. I'm breaking. And I was like, we need to take the whole month of August
off.
And
I was like, well, I don't have a home. I'm still displaced. So, yes.
Sounds great.
I have a home now, though. So that's exciting.
She does. We're so proud of her.
I did move into my new home.
But, you know, the good news is, like, hopefully, maybe during the month of August, we're going to be doing some guest appearances on some other podcasts and things to talk about our book that's coming out September 22nd.
That's some wishful thinking, huh?
Listen, I'm going to make
kidding.
It happen.
No, we are. Because our book is coming out.
September 22nd.
You guys, it's getting closer and closer. The date that it was supposed to came out already came and went.
Came and went.
And that's okay.
We'd be a bestseller by now
that's
if it came
okay.
out in May.
Thanks a lot, COVID-19. But it's still coming out September 22nd. You can pre-order it, Kindle and hardcover.
All those things.
And it's really exciting. And we're going to do interview after interview.
Oh, my God. There's going to be the press that you're going to see in our social media is just going to be.
Through the roof.
Jamie.
Through the roof.
But wait, we do have to say we're going to be back on Monday the 7th of September.
Mm-hmm. Wait, what's Helen? Where are we putting Helen for the break?
Where's she going? She's told me she's staying with you.
She's not staying with me. Okay, she can stay with me.
Oh, my God. I can't wait for some Helen stories. Jamie!
Who's that?
I ate some breakfast!
That's
Helen.
I don't know what that was.
Helen.
Helen.
I'm not hitting record. Oh, not doing it.
People, Helen is not real, guys. Just in case you were
That was Helen. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So wait, but we do want to also say that for those live streams, we are shifting to Thursdays at 2 p.m. starting August. So we'll still have our live streams on in August. So you don't have to miss us.
You can see us. We're still going to be doing it.
They're going to be on Facebook Live.
Homes with our children.
Oh, God.
All the time. All the time.
And sweating.
Stuff. Yep. It's hot. Anyway. You guys, we got to say a special thank you to our newest Patreon members.
Oh, my God. So many new members.
Let's try to say their names as best we can.
Do you think we cannot butcher them?
I think they're good.
Let's do it.
Savannah Strennan, you rock, girlfriend. Thank you so much.
Sarah,
whoa. Yeah. I'm going to do a little something for her.
Okay, do it,
Sarah LaRonca, you. Oh, I love you.
Okay.
George.
She does, Sarah.
I do. George Otiono, you rock. You are it. That's who you are.
And don't forget Michelle and Allison. Tell them you love them too, Jamie.
I love you.
I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's happening for Jamie right now, but we are so thankful to all of you guys.
Yeah, and if you would like to join our Patreon community and support us, you're going to get all kinds of bonus content. We're talking videos and swag for joining, like really cool stickers. You can just head over to patreon.com/ovariestalk, and it really helps the podcast get out to more and more people. We need support from wonderful folks like you, so thank you so much.
And we're even putting up unedited ad-free videos of some of our interviews at the gestational carrier level.
According to my mom, that's the best part of it. So
Jamie's mom, it's Jamie's mom approved.
It's Mama Sue approved. Anyway, we are really talking a lot. So,
I know, we don't want to talk too much because this is a jam-packed, extra-long bonus episode.
This is a good
finale.
Okay, so we're bringing in Amanda and Gab. They have been trying forever, been through IVF, and they've been through miscarriage. They have a really long journey. But on top of that, during their process, they experienced, which many of us have, all kinds of bias and microaggressions for being LGBTQ. So we're getting deep into it with them about all of that. And instead of living with it, Amanda and Gab went straight to the top of the clinic and demanded change. You guys, you have to hear this. They did so much greatness for our community.
They did so much greatness.
I had to say it that way.
Okay.
Yeah. They're amazing. Let's get into it so we don't ruin
it. Let's roll the tape, Helen. Roll the tape, Helen.
Helen!
Hi, Amanda and Gab.
Hi.
Guys.
Welcome.
Welcome to our podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having us. This is very exciting.
And especially for joining us early at accommodating the 9:30 hour, because we're up. As moms, we've been up for days. So we're like, I don't know, can you do it early so we can have the rest of the day?
It was definitely a conversation, for sure.
So should we start where we always start, which is with the elevator pitch of you guys? Hold on a second. I'm getting out a little.
We do time you now. We do time you.
It'll be short and sweet, believe me.
It used to be very long, and now it's extremely short.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Because, like, if you had a category.
Go ahead.
If you had a category called It's Complicated, it's because it usually starts there.
Oh, it's exciting.
Okay, on your mark. Get set. Go.
Okay, so Gab and I were both married previous to meeting each other, and we were both in open relationships at the end of our marriage at that point, both for reasons that were related to those relationships being unhealthy, so not the greatest way to enter a non-monogamous relationship. So the long story short is that the first time I met Gab, I was having you and your wife over for dinner. And I was like, should I change? No, they're just going to be friends. And then as soon as she walked in the door, I was like, I should have changed my clothes. Anyway, I spent 6 weeks trying to flirt with her. She didn't notice me. And then we finally got together.
Yeah.
You divorced your wife shortly after that. And I left my partner about a year and a half later. And that was the best decision ever. And we stayed together. And here we are.
Totally. And it took me so long because I don't pick up on nuance. I'm a very literal person. And so she literally had to bash me over the head with a 2x4 and like, oh, hey. No, sorry. Not literally.
All right. I'm stopping you. You got our first award for doubling the time and I love it.
Oh, I thought it was one Amazing. Minute. I thought we were like, oh, well, we did good. It was only
we did really
seconds
well. Yeah,
over.
No,
you did great. You did great. I love it.
You did great.
Sorry.
Yeah. You did
complicated.
Great. No,
it's complicated.
It's complicated.
I love it.
So wait, I want to know, Gab, you were married to a woman previously. Amanda, was it a woman with you as well?
No, I was married to a man for 12 years.
Scandalous. 12 years. How old are you? You look 9.
So that might have been, you know, in retrospect, I think it was a little young to make a decision like that. I met him when I was 19 and we got married when I was 23.
Wow.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow. Right. Okay. So for a long time, you were married to a man and you guys were both in open relationships because it was towards the end of your marriages.
Yeah. Yeah. So my husband had a girlfriend that he was dating. I was dating Gab. I tend to just talk for us both. So you go ahead and
that's okay. I also feel like as a disclaimer, we're probably like everyone who actually does like non-monogamy well are probably like, oh, these two, like this is exactly like who we don't want to hear from.
Because you ended up being monogamous.
We're not good representations of a healthy non-monogamous relationship.
Well, maybe you two were just doing non-monogamy because you wanted out. Like maybe that's what you were doing. I don't know.
That was our choice.
It was like a gentler, kindler
we're
breakup.
Monogamous now.
Amanda, had you dated women before you met Gab?
No.
Interesting. Oh.
Okay. So you saw her. It was like,
it wasn't the first time that I felt or knew that I was attracted to women. So in high school, I knew that I wasn't straight. And remember, I'm from small town, Northern Ontario. So growing up in small town, Northern Ontario in the 90s, there wasn't all the language that we have now for LGBTQ. Sure.
Well, there wasn't really the choice either.
There wasn't, right? I didn't know a single gay person in all of my city from Thunder Bay, Ontario. It was very homophobic there as well. And I didn't have any concept of gender non-binary, gender queer, butch women or like transmasculine women, which those like that group is who I tend to be drawn to. So in my mind, when I was in high school, I was like, well, I'm not straight. And the language was you're either straight or you're gay. There was no in between, right? So I was like, well, I'm not straight, but I like boys and dating boys, but I don't feel straight. But if I'm gay and not straight, then when I kiss a girl, it should be 10 times better than when I kiss a boy. So then I was just kissed red girl, because the narrative around queer people at the time too was hypersexuality, right? So that concept of like, well, if you're gay, you love everyone. You want to have sex with everyone. So I'm like, okay, I'll kiss a random girl. See what it's like. She's not my type. She's not, there's no spark. So then I was like, okay, well, I must not be gay. I must just be like kind of wavery straight, I guess.
Wavery straight.
Yeah. So then I left Thunder Bay and I went to university and I went to a university that was very progressive. There was a very large queer community there. There was a large polyamorous community there. And it really like opened my eyes. And I felt for the first time that I could say to myself, I'm queer. And that's the word that I use to describe myself. I'm like, it's not that I prefer men over women or women over men or anything like that. I guess if someone were to label me pansexual would be the most appropriate term, meaning that if I like who you are, I'll likely be drawn to you, but I also have a type. Anyway, it's complicated. Everything is complicated. That's our theme.
This episode's going to be titled It's Complicated.
Yeah. Yes. But you know, very quickly within that community, my university community, people started talking to me about the word tourist. And they, you know, the message was made very clear to me that if you're not clear that you're gay, don't date women because you'll be taking advantage of them. And it's not okay to use women as your plaything to find out who you are. So because I wasn't clear, I really hesitated because I'm like, I don't want to make someone feel used or taken advantage of. I didn't feel I had the right to name myself as queer because of that narrative. I felt like I didn't have the right to that identity if I wasn't sure.
And I feel like that stinks a little bit. It's thoughtful, but I feel like that stinks because how else are you supposed to figure your world out if not in relationship?
Yeah.
Like that seems really unfair. Like, I can't figure out if I like a food without trying it. I'm just saying.
Yeah. You know, since then I realized I'm like, the whole concept of it is silly because again, the narrative that I heard around gay folks and whatnot is like, well, how did you know you're gay if you hadn't had a relationship with a woman? I'm like, well, you don't have to know that you're straight if you haven't had a relationship. It's just accepted that you're straight. So now I'm like, this, and this is what I try to share at Pride and whatnot, is happy Pride to everyone, including those who have never been in a visibly queer relationship, because it's enough that you know your identity to have that identity. And that's okay.
Wow, you're a very, very thoughtful person, Amanda. This is you're taking my mind to places I haven't taken it. So thank you. Interesting. Oh man, we're in some really strange times right now, Robin.
Tell me about it. I'm falling apart, Jamie.
I know. You know what? Maybe it's time for you to go back to BetterHelp.
I mean, it's not a bad idea.
I mean, you and I went. It's online counseling, guys. It helped us.
Yeah.
I know. So here's what they do. They assess your needs and they match you with your own licensed professional therapist. And you can start communicating with that therapist in under 48 hours, which you already know, Robin. I don't have to tell you this.
You don't have to tell me.
I also would like to remind you that it's not a crisis line. It is not self-help. It is professional counseling done, get this, securely online. That's the best part.
Oh, my God. And you know what I also love for everyone is not just me who needs the help, as we all have established that they have just this really big range of expertise available, which maybe you're not going to get in your local area if you're living in a smaller town.
True.
And the service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor, and you're going to get a timely and thoughtful response, which is awesome.
Yep.
Plus, in addition to like the texting and whatever, you can also schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to leave, you know, your air-conditioned home and sit in an uncomfortable waiting room.
Your socially distanced quarantined home.
Exactly.
Oh. Anyway, listen, here's what Robin also loves about this. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available, which is great.
I mean, that's everything right now, right?
Everything.
We're all broke.
We're all trapped. Trying to live our best lives, guys. So listen, guys, BetterHelp is here to help us. They want you to start living a happier life today. Visit BetterHelp.com/OCT. That's Better, H-E-L-P. And join the over 1 million people charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional online.
Isn't that crazy? A million people. So many people have been using BetterHelp.
We need this.
That they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states.
Because it's good.
Oh, my God. So this is a special offer for our listeners. Get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/OCT.
10%, guys.
Get healthy.
We need this. Everybody needs this. Okay, so you end up with Gab, decide to be monogamous. Gab, do you have anything you want to add to the story of meeting? Like, how long were you married to your wife?
Well, we were together for a total of 6 years and really only married for like 36 months. I feel like it's one of those like celebrity weddings that dissolve, you know? So, you know, it was a good while. But yeah, it was when, you know, I finally clued into Amanda. I just remember like my mind was blown and I had never experienced that range of feeling for somebody before. And I was like, this, no matter what, like this person's the person for me.
Oh, and look at how loving, they're looking at each other so lovingly.
Remember
too.
That, Jamie?
I can't with the love. Yeah, I know.
Remember before kids? Oh.
We're super cheesy.
I love it. It's nice.
It's great. You should be.
How did you start talking about kids? When did you start talking about kids?
Pretty 5 years ago.
That's a while ago.
Yeah. That's when the journey began. Wow. It's frightening.
Well, let's hear it.
Let's dig into this. Because like we said, it's complicated.
Yes.
It's complicated. Absolutely. Like I just feel like every adventure that we've had in our life has just resulted in it's complicated. We have this thing called Gab luck, where it's just like, if the worst case scenario will unfold in a particular moment, it absolutely will. And so,
or at least the most inconvenient.
The most inconvenient, where it's just like, really? Like, how did all of the wrong things happen all in a row? And it's like, well, that's just what we call Gab luck. But we started talking in 2015, because I think there was just that piece around like really loving our relationship and wanting to be together and having that commitment for the future. And both of us have always wanted to have a family.
We went with a sperm donor through a sperm bank.
And then we took a little break.
So you did one, it didn't work, and you took a break.
Yeah.
Well, we I don't think we even got to the first one with our first clinic. Because remember when we were choosing our sperm, we asked our doctor, is there anything we should know about how to choose sperm? And he said, no, just pick the person that you like and you want. So we did. And then when we actually got to the clinic, they said, oh, your donor is CMV positive and I'm CMV negative and I was the intended carrier. And so they didn't want to do the IUI because there's a very minuscule risk of the baby being born with some variations in growth and development. So they didn't want to do it. And I was like, wait a second. You told me that I didn't have to take into consideration any of this stuff. And they're like, well, why don't you just change your donor? I'm like, excuse me.
And we had just bought $4,000 on like a handful of vials.
You bought a bunch. Yeah. Cause that's what we need to do. Cause
that was the instruction that we received at the time without any warning. And like the CMV piece was the one that really like messed us up at the beginning.
Oh, that's infuriating.
And now the CMV thing, because heterosexual couples who get pregnant, they don't know their CMV status.
They will never be tested for, like, it will never be known.
The only time they are tested is if they've had a late term stillbirth. So we did a lot of advocacy and we lost that battle. And we had to go to another clinic. We went through 5 other clinics before we found one that would use the sperm that we bought.
Really? Oh, so you wanted to go forward anyway. You were like, it's fine.
We were very committed to our donor.
Yeah. And I read the research. I read the papers and I felt that the risk was low enough that I was going to take that risk. And it took us 5 clinics to find a doctor who could confirmed that I understood the research properly and that I was a consenting adult and could make my own decision and supported us.
It's so crazy. If it's going to be a factor, like, and if they inseminate you or not, then they should be upfront and tell us that you need to check, you need to make sure this donor is CMV negative.
Yeah.
Like what?
And how are they not knowledgeable on that? That's offensive.
It really is. Yeah.
You have one job, which is to understand all the nuances of how you're making babies for people, and you don't understand that, and you know you're talking to a same-sex couple. That's offensive.
Because I know nobody told me about the CMV. I've only heard about the CMV status on this podcast.
I had to ask my doctor about it, and they gave us bad information too. But it just turned out to be fine.
Well, I think it's kind of wild. There's a lot of issues at hand, right? I think that one of them is that like these businesses operate in silos, right? So the sperm bank is a completely different business than the fertility clinic. The sperm bank has really no investment in ensuring that you pick out sperm that's good for you, which I think is problematic because they should have a relationship with one another. I think it's a matter of principle too around the autonomy of choice where Amanda and I, like, so she mentioned that we went through these 5 different clinics. And so our tone and approach dramatically changed as we started the conversation. And then by the 5th clinic, like Amanda was essentially calling being like, I'm not even coming in until you tell me whether or not your clinic will do this. I don't want to go through a whole assessment just to find out that you're going to say no, because a lot of these clinics were relying on their legal team as opposed to our personal preference and choice to make a decision. And when they're relying on their legal team, they're essentially following recommendations, but it wasn't embedded in legislation. So it was a legal recommendation, but it wasn't law.
About lawsuits.
So, yeah.
They're worried about lawsuits.
It's a risk mitigation strategy, but it's also like not great business practice when you're working in healthcare. And so,
right.
You know, I'm somebody that works in healthcare, so I feel very principled about how we treat people and their autonomy of choice within our healthcare systems.
Oh, what do you do in healthcare?
I work in community health and specifically with substance use. And as of the last 3 months, I've been redeployed to work in COVID positive hotels for folks that are users of the shelter systems to ensure that they have a safe recovery from COVID.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
That's got to take a toll. Heavy. I can't even imagine that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm somebody who really likes to walk through fire. So for me, this was a really exciting opportunity. I was like, oh yeah, this totally sounds like the unknown and total chaos. Let's do it.
Well, good. I think you're in the right place then. Oh my goodness. Okay. So
the 5th clinic, you got someone to do it.
Yes. So we did 3 IUI initially.
Yeah.
3 IUI that didn't work. And then we moved to IVF.
We moved to IVF because the funding piece came through.
Right. So in Ontario, I don't know if it's across Canada or if it's just Ontario. You're covered for a round of IVF through the government. If you do single embryo transfers, but your drugs aren't covered. It cuts the cost in half, roughly. It's still a lot of money, but it cuts the cost in half. Yeah. We were getting to the point where we were just like, okay, if we increase our chances and can decrease our cost, then let's try IVF. We decided that my egg count is low and Gab's was very, very high.
This is also very much a Gab luck thing because I really didn't want to have much to do with the process other than being a really supportive partner.
So it was decided, much to your chagrin, that Gab would do the egg extraction and we would create embryos with her eggs and then I would carry them. So we started with that and that's where we started to have some issues with the clinic. Oh.
What kind of issues did you have with the clinic?
Oh, you know, generalized homophobia and those microaggressions that come out. And it's funny because I'll say this, like, it's very much like all of the isms issue that we face societally is that I think on an everyday basis, like, it's not coming out as any really direct piece, but it's all in the microaggression interactions that we have throughout the day. So I find that fertility clinics, so I feel like now that we have the sense of five, I can say kind of like, the sense is it's a very feminized space. You know, and there's a lot of narrative around like a feminized pregnancy and like you're glowing and you're beautiful and all these pieces. And here I am having to transition our plan where I'm like, I don't want anything to do with this. But now I say that sounds so crass, but I mean, like, I hope that the spirit of what I'm saying is coming through.
No, it's landing. It's landing.
It is. Yeah.
You know, to then being like, okay, there's a bit of grief for me that I have to manage around like changing my approach and using my body in a way that I wasn't anticipating I was going to have to use it. So the messaging that was coming through was already one that was like really grating on me and creating some tensions, but I was like, okay, we'll put that one aside. And then pieces that would unfold would be like when I'd go get my blood work done. So I remember going in this one morning and I'd had this sweet, fresh fade and I totally loved my like lovely buzz cut. And I have these aviator glasses. And as you can see, I have a very square head. And so I get misread in public often. And so they'd called out my legal name. And so I stood up, went to the blood tech. And then she proceeded to look around me and keep calling the name because she totally read me as a dude and was like, oh,
you're right here, essentially, you're in the wrong place.
Yeah. And at which point I had to then like lean into her and say, hi, I'm the person that you're calling right now. And she went through those reactions that people go through when they're mortified and embarrassed that they made a huge mistake. Uh-huh. And it was kind of like shock, light, like repulsion, like reassessment. And then let's pretend none of this ever happened. And then kind of ushered me into the chair to do my blood work. And I was just like, oh man. God. So it was things like that I had
instead of just being like, I'm sorry, and then walking back with you. That's all she had to do.
Totally be like, I misread the situation. I don't know, just be honest. You know, like I get it. It happens all the time. You know, so there was that. And then there were issues with the transvaginal ultrasound where people were uncomfortable with me and didn't know how to like navigate my body and would just like ignore me essentially. And then like not talk me through the process of a transvaginal ultrasound and just like insert and like, you know, so it was very abrupt and difficult because they weren't necessarily experienced around how to work with somebody who was like gender nonconforming or on a transmasculine scale, like that sort of thing. And so, yeah, so those were very frequent interactions that I would have with the clinic.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That sounds horrible.
Our clinic had inclusive signage up, meaning just the like the rainbow triangle with the like all are welcome kind of thing. But it became really apparent in those moments that I'm like, you have the intention, but your approach is that you're nice and you're good intention, but you clearly haven't really done any learning around what that actually means. What inclusion
that always sounds to me like it was a business decision. Like somebody somewhere said, yeah, we want to, this is a whole group of people that we can profit off of. Let's open up to them. But then they don't take that next step of saying, we need to make sure the people in the clinic are trained and understand how to work with different populations of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just like showing face, but not doing the work. inclusivity is always the goal. And that's why that your story is so important right now, because this is the stuff.
And
right
I
here.
Wouldn't,
so,
and I, we're in the same community of people. I would not have known about, I hadn't thought about the microaggressions and what you would go through. Like when you just said the transvaginal thing, like that's horrifying. Like what that would feel like to have someone just like insert that thing without just like walking you through it. Like that's,
yeah.
I'm like just, yeah. It's rare. Yeah. I'm speechless.
I mean, it's just like, you know, I know that people like to dismiss microaggressions because it makes them uncomfortable to have to deal with the issues at hand. And, you know, I can tell you very much the difference when people have treated me with respect and kindness versus when you find me disgusting. Like, I, you know, there's a good range there, and I totally can feel the difference. And, you know, like I remember one time with one of the transveg, I've had so many this one time. I'm like, let me tell you the great ones and the horrible ones. But somebody who didn't even look at me the whole time, like she made no, like we never connected. And I was like, this is cold. Like, it's so cold. And I'm like, you're about to do something incredibly private and intimate and vulnerable. So
yeah.
Patient care people.
Seriously, patient care people.
Our first IUI, you know, like we were at the beginning of our journey, you know, we're blissed out and we're excited. And of course it's going to work and all that stuff. Right. So our first IUI, like we're holding each other and like, this is so wonderful. And then the doctor finishes, and it wasn't our normal doctor, it's a different doctor. He finishes and he says, okay, everything went smoothly, but you might want to get tested for cancer because your cervix bled a little bit and that can be a sign of cancer. See you later. And he walked out. I was like,
what?
I think that they are scientists and they have no bedside manner. They just don't know.
Yeah.
For me, I feel very passionate about equity in healthcare. And so I'm like, you don't belong in the field if you are not going to serve everybody with the exact same standard and level of healthcare. Like, find something else to do. There's lots of jobs out there.
Agreed. Okay. So let's get back into your guys' story.
Yeah. So maybe I'd call it an empathy builder too, on the flip side, whereas like I also didn't want to have anything to do with it. I also started like having some serious symptoms that I was like, oh, this is only the beginning place of like what women go through who, you know, want to carry a baby. And I remember being at work and so bloated and I had to do like undo my pants in like staff meetings. I'm like, sorry guys, this is just what's happening. And I'm an oversharer. So everyone always knows what's happening in my life. So we did two rounds of IVF. This was round one back in 2018. I remember going in and like, you know, you have no idea what it's going to feel like or how it's going to be. And luckily I've had lots of contact with healthcare. And like, I know that like I need, you know, a good dose of anesthesia and I just don't want to feel it. And so, you know, they gave me like a little cocktail of pills before we went in. And during the extraction, I experienced like an exorbitant amount of pain. And I was like, what the hell is going on? This totally does not feel okay. And I felt like, you know, that scene from The Exorcist where like the back bent backwards and like, you're just like clutching the bed sheets and like that whole piece. So that was essential. And Amanda was there. She can attest to the exorcism that occurred that day. But
Gab, you were awake?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, fully wow. Conscious. I was always put under.
Oh,
lucky for my extraction.
Oh my God. She's like, oh.
You had requested that. She had requested that. But
I had requested
that. I can't believe it.
Yeah, but yeah, no, they tell me it's not going to be that bad. It'll be fine. You know, you're okay in a conscious state. And so I was conscious through it. And then halfway through the extraction, I was like begging for more drugs because I was like, this does not feel right, does not feel normal, but like, what do I know? I've never gone through this process before. So I was just like, maybe this is just how it is. And so then like took about 20 minutes or so.
I was not going through it. I was watching and supporting, but in my life prior to what I do now, I'm in HR now, but for 10 years I was a doula and supported people through childbirth. So seeing, I'm like, I feel like I have a good read on the seriousness of someone's intensity. And I'm like, what I saw you going through was very similar to what I see someone going through when their epidural hasn't worked.
Yes. And that's what I was thinking. That's exactly what I was thinking.
When they've been counting on that relief and it's not working. So you have the pain, but you also have the panic and the grief. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's a good summary.
Yeah. Okay.
And also a feeling of like, I thought it was supposed to help more, because that my second kid, I like the epidural wasn't helping. And I was like, this isn't what I remember from the first, but only because I'd had a first kid did I know to speak up about it.
Yeah.
And they were
yeah.
like, do you want more? I was like, yes, I want more.
Yes. So
I'm still shocked well, that they didn't put you under.
So yeah, so this was part of what developed into the problem, as we learned in 2019 when we did our second round of IVF. And I think that the first round, like the best way I can describe it was it felt like blowtorch and razor blades. Like that is like, if I could summarize it, that would be the physical experience that I had.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I'm going to spoiler alert, because I think that it's important that listeners know what happened there. So when we went for our second round of IVF, and we'll circle back to what happened with our fertility journey in between them, but we had asked to see the doctor prior to the procedure so that Gab could discuss pain options because of what happened before. It was at that point that it was disclosed to us that the doctor in the first egg extraction didn't do local anesthetic.
Because actually, this is what it looked like. The nurse opened my chart, essentially saw which doctor did the surgery last year, and went, so he doesn't believe in anesthetic, were the literal words that came out of her mouth. And this was 5 minutes before I was going to go into my second procedure. And I was just like, what the fuck? Like, I remember freaking out in that moment. Yeah.
I had
one Ativan. That was what that little cocktail of pills was a year prior.
Oh my God.
Yeah. We looked at our consent forms because we're like, you know, and this is that thing that like, I don't know if it's that what the word is, the gaslighting or self-doubt or whatever. We were like, what did we do wrong that this happened?
Yeah,
so we like looked through our consents and we're like, no, our consent form for this procedure said that you would get pills and local anesthetic. Mm. So I'm like, why did we sign something that says that that's, well, this is what led to us deciding that it was time to provide feedback to the clinic was this event.
Yeah.
And it was like those things, like we break down what happened that day in terms of trauma aware care. The consents weren't honored. A decision about pain relief was decided on behalf of an autonomous person. Their communication about what they did need in terms of pain relief was dismissed in the moment. And phrases like it'll only be a minute, keep breathing, just distracted, like those dismissive comments. Platitudes that are actually like very triggering words to use for someone who's trying to get through a distressful, traumatic moment were used. You know, those are the kinds of things that I'm like, this is not a trauma aware. This clinic doesn't have a trauma aware lens to it. In addition to not having a LGBTQ inclusive lens, they also don't have a trauma aware lens. So it was pretty awful. And we like, you took a long time to process that before you were ready to provide feedback.
Yeah. So when we learned this bit in 2019 around what happened in 2018, like that period of time that Amanda's talking about is like exploring the what do you want to do options, right? And I think that for me as an operating principal, I usually want to go through the path that will generate significant or meaningful change in a way. So I know we had talked about litigation as an option, but I don't actually find that to really resolve the issue, where I'm just like, okay, well, clearly we're up against the values and principles issue. Litigation doesn't tend to really shift perspectives on that. It just, I find that pathway often creates more tensions and maybe won't necessarily prevent other people from having that experience as well. And so what is it that we can do to actually create that change so that people can have a better patient care experience?
So that's why you decided to provide feedback and offer training as opposed to litigation. Yeah.
So before we go into all the amazing work you guys are doing with the clinic, we're assuming that first IVF didn't work.
Yeah. So we got three embryos from that first IVF.
Yep.
And we had one pregnancy.
Yeah, the first two didn't take, and then the third resulted in miscarriage.
Mm. Oh, it was awful.
So sorry.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
But I did feel like a champ because the second time I got 10 embryos out of it. So I was just like, okay, yeah. I rocked that
Whoa.
One.
But that's a lot. That must have been that general anesthesia.
I was more relaxed.
So yeah. You got 10 embryos the second time. And then
after the miscarriage, the clinic has a policy that you have to wait a certain number of months before you try again. And that was really upsetting to me. And I'll probably get emotional about it. But, you know, it became really obvious to me at that point how many parts of a queer couple of our nature having a baby is in the hands of someone else. Like, we don't have sperm between us. So we first had to find a donor. And then CMV, like, someone decided that they weren't going to use our sperm because we didn't have a CMV match. And we had to fight for that. And then, you know, we had to fight for funding. And luckily, our province is one that has allowed queer couples to access fertility care to begin with, but then to also provide us access to the funding. But it's the government's decision. It hasn't always been the case. And it can change, as we're seeing in the States right now as well. It can change, right? And then mm-hmm. to have the miscarriage and people telling us stupid things like, oh, you know, I know people who, like, as soon as they stopped trying, they got pregnant. As soon as they didn't, you know, like.
Yeah, no, that was said.
Yeah, like that multiple times. And I'm like, it's not really an option for us. But that piece of, like, I felt that in my grief of the miscarriage, I could feel that if we could keep trying, that would help me with my grief. And if we were a heterosexual couple, even if it didn't work, we could keep trying at home. And that would have helped me mm-hmm. with my grief. But even my grief process was bound by the decisions and the framework and the structure of the medical system that was helping me to become pregnant. And I was so angry about it for so long. Mm-hmm. So that mm-hmm. was a piece I'm like, I found it really hard to find fertility support groups that reflected the parts of the fertility process that I found to be a struggle because of my queer identity. And that's how I found you guys, actually. And this podcast is such a huge help for me during that time. And I remember writing to you guys and you wrote me back right away. And it really helped to hear stories where my process was reflected. It really helped a lot. But
oh my God, I wish we were all in the same room so we could, like, give you a hug. I'm so sorry.
I'm crying. But that's why we made this podcast. I was looking for the same stories. They weren't out. They're not out there. We're mm-hmm. not out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard, right? Because these are the ways in which our current structures make our stories invisible, right? And keep trying to erase us over time. And I have a lot of fight in my body against that because I refuse to be erased and I refuse to see the people that I love be erased. And these are experiences, right?
This wasn't the day mm-hmm. to put mascara on. I'll tell you what, I didn't know we were crying during this interview.
I knew I was going to cry and I put mascara on. So I don't know.
Oh God. I'm so thankful that you reached out to us. And I'm so thankful that you're highlighting this. And I feel so complicit right now. This is why I'm so upset. I feel so complicit for not understanding the level of what our people go through, even though we have this podcast and even though I've been through it. Like, hearing your story is just, I can't even, I don't even know what else to say. It's just so heartbreaking. So I'm so thankful that you reached out to us, that we could be talking about this, because this is incredibly important.
It's important. Okay. So, all right.
Yeah. Damn it, you too.
Sorry.
Well, we warned you. It's complicated. So
you should. Yeah, it's complicated.
The theme.
Yeah. So I found you guys. Yep. You were great support. I also found a book called Swelling with Pride, which was stories of different queer couples building their families, which was really lovely. Found a Facebook group that's breast and chest feeding and birthing trans men and allies, which I shadow. I find that to be just reading other people's stories to be really supportive in some other places. But I wanted to share them on the podcast because it was so hard for me to find them that I wanted to just share them here. But
That's great.
Well, so yeah, so you said you advocacy. Where did you go from there? Like, you processed it. Did you said you went back to the clinic to tell them to stop being turds? I mean, what did you do?
that is a really like succinct summary. Yeah, I mean, you have to change everything that you're doing. I think that for us, like the tipping point in June of 2019 was finding out about the piece around anesthetic. And for me, I just had enough. I was just like, okay, listen, like I have space for mistakes as well. I'm like, I get that like everything's an imperfect process, but the systematic issues that had come up were just far too great to just let it go. If this was kind of a one-off and just like this was a huge oversight, sorry, I'd have been like, okay, like I get that happens in life. Like that happens in all of our professions. But between our starting point and June of 2019, like we'd gone through just so many issues with the clinic that, you know, I was like, okay, if this is how I'm feeling, I can count on the fact that like so many other people have probably had this experience, but just like want to get through it and don't want to rock the boat or just like don't have the energy to, and all the reasonable reasons why you just want to like put it behind you, right? Like that I totally get. But for us, like Amanda and I are both people that like love to speak up. We like addressing systems issues and working towards like, again, equitable care and actual safe environments for people. This isn't to say by any stretch that we're any kind of expert on the topic, but I know what I went through. And if I can just make a little dent in the structure, then I feel like we're making some headway.
Yeah. So what'd you do? What have you guys done so far?
So we brought, I mean, I think that we did have some luck. We ended up meeting with the CEO of the clinic and we had this 2-hour meeting with her around the list of things that had happened from the series of microaggressions to the extraction without anesthetic, and kind of everything in between, and just been like, okay, like, from our experience as LGBT folks, like, let me tell you what would have made the standard of care that much better for us. And again, like, this is really just telling our story, not to say that this is true for everybody, because I'm sure that there's lots of pieces that we don't even see that others experience. And why we were so lucky is because we weren't placated in that exchange, where I find in a lot of corporate settings, we're like, oh yeah, yeah, we'll totally do something. And then you just get dismissed because it's too difficult to make a change. We actually were dealing with somebody who had the same kind of passion for good business model and standard of care. And so she really took everything that we had to say to heart and wanted to make an actionable change.
That's incredible.
Awesome.
We went into that meeting expecting to probably not be
left off.
Yeah. Like And I think this is a piece too, is it was a good year or so after the egg extraction that we gave this feedback. So we had already started our second round of IVF, but knowing that when you give feedback like this, it's likely or it's possible that you're not going to be received well. We were like, let's wait until we can receive any kind of response before we give feedback. And that's why I say to people, I'm like, it is never too late to give feedback. Mm-hmm. Never. But it's important that if you want to, that you're in a place where you won't be further harmed by their response. And so we went in, let's provide feedback, let's provide suggestions, and let's connect them with training and resources, because we've both done those trainings before, facilitated them. We've been a part of and attended other trainings. So we just went in being like, here are some people who can help you with this. But the CEO was so touched by speaking to us and know that we've done the trainings before, she asked us if we would be the people to do the overview and training because she wanted the client perspective as a part of the message.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's incredible. They were probably so thrilled that you didn't come in with a lawyer. I'll tell you what. Because you could have.
Yeah. 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 And we told her we hadn't decided yet if we were going to do that. And that wasn't a threat. I was just like, I want to be clear. This is not an exchange, but we're still processing that experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
When she asked us to do it, we took a couple of days to think about it, and I called her back and I was like, okay, listen, here's what I think. I'm like, if you want to do this training, if what you're telling me is that LGBTQ inclusion is important enough for your clinic to do this training, then it needs to be mandatory for everyone. It's D&I is not going to have the traction, the legs, and the momentum and impact you want if you do what everyone else does and make it an optional thing that isn't consistent. So I'm like, the trainings need to be mandatory. And she said, okay. And then I'm like, all right. So if the training's mandatory, I'm going to assume in your staff of 100 that there's going to be some people who just don't believe this at all and are really hard to buy in. So before we do the training at all, I would need to review all of your materials, HR policy, clinic policy, consent forms, intake forms, newsletters, signage, everything, website, everything. Because if the message you're sending to your staff is that this is important, but then they don't have the tools to back up that message, they're not going to buy in. She said, okay.
Right.
So I'm like, okay.
You got yourself another full-time job right there.
Oh, yeah. It was so much more work than you.
It was, yeah. And then I said to her, I was like, all right. So if what you're telling your staff is that it's mandatory, then it needs to be a part of their performance management indicators. And we're going to put it on their performance management. And if that's part of their performance management, you have to be ready to terminate someone who's not interested in integrating this into their practice. And she said, okay.
Holy
if
cow.
That's indeed what your clinic is upholding as a value, as a standard for work, like this is, yeah, it's integral.
I mean, you guys implemented an amazing amount of change. And I just keep going back to what you said, Gab, about how like you thought about it being a lawyer wasn't the route because it wasn't going to change what was happening. And because you held that value, you guys were able to make change that is going to affect countless other people. Incredible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think like for me, just fundamentally, I should just like say that, I tend to not be one for punitive approaches. You don't go very many places. Right. So even though the long game is so much harder, more arduous, much more time consuming, and can take up an enormous amount of emotional resources, I want to see us thrive as a society. And so I think taking that route is so helpful for me.
Yeah.
So yeah, last June we started reviewing, we started with their consent forms review, and like, good God, I had budgeted 3 hours to review consent forms. It took the two of us 10 hours to review their consent forms.
Oh my God.
The language was so archaic. It was like anywhere you could put in the word woman or male, it was like a compulsion. It was like, you can't just say ovaries. You have to say the woman's ovaries. It was just,
oh my God.
Yeah, it was everywhere.
The thing that sticks with me is because I work in the field of substance use, it's just like archaic discrimination and stigma around, you know, people who use drugs is like riddled all over this. I'm like, this is so irrelevant to the fertility journey. Like, and it's really problematizing, you know, a particular experience. It's not relevant. And so I had a lot of joy in like, being able to scrap the entire document that spoke to substance use and like archaic HIV policy that made zero sense in 2020. Like you know, it was all laid in with discrimination. And I'm like, this just has to go as a whole. Yeah. So that was very satisfying for me.
There was no room for non-monogamous couples. There's no room for co-parenting groups in their forms either, which in Toronto, there's a growing body of folks from both of those family groups that are building families together and don't have space or representation in the forums. So we were able to really bring in a lot of pieces outside of the LGBTQ inclusion to make the forums just more inclusive for a lot of different family groups.
That's incredible. Amazing. Most people just sign these forms and barely read them. You know?
I mean, we did the first time too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we did that. And then I was like, what does your recruiting material look like? I was like, show me your job descriptions. Show me your interview questions. Are you screening properly for people who will uphold these values moving forward? So we started working on that.
I remember one of the job descriptions was just referring to she in such a stereotype, like feminized profession. And I was just like, oh my God, why are we reinforcing these pieces like this? This is a job description. It does not have a sex or gender. So like, let's just like take it out. So
that's crazy. Wow.
I feel like you took this clinic, you wrung it, got all that water and created like a whole new
laundry spun out clinic. Does that make sense? That's my brain. Oh God. Yeah. You just created systemic change.
Yeah.
Boom.
So we took a year to give them all the recommendations for their back end. And then we started the trainings in March of this year, just before the pandemic.
Yeah.
We just, of course.
So we designed.
Actually, the cool thing with the trainings too is that they ended up dividing it into two groups. So they had, this was actually a really great strategy, is to do one of the trainings with the body of doctors alone, mm-hmm. and then the other training with all of the staff. So nursing staff, admin staff, techs, all of that, you know, and I think that that was, for the context, you know, a better design or better approach to being able to have that, because the doctor group was much smaller, you know, and there's like mm-hmm. the power hierarchies, like you want to kind of isolate that in order to have like learning have the most impact. Right. And that was a really interesting experience for me, because the doctor that had performed the original extraction was part of that cohort for that piece. So it's just like, okay, well, you know, like this is our face-to-face moment where we get to share our story and he's right there.
Wow.
Wow. How'd that go?
What'd he do?
You know, I found observing that really interesting. And this is where I say, like, we can never identify how profound and how deeply buried our prejudice is, because I legitimately believe that in his case, it wasn't coming from a conscious place. I think it was just like historic prejudice that was so deeply rooted that that was just how it was. And it was very casual, right? And I remember observing him throughout the duration of the workshop. And like, he really looked like he was taking in this information, like this was new to him. And so for me, that was a really great opportunity to really appreciate the depth of prejudice and how providing somebody with the educational opportunity to change is really imperative, because at no point in time would I say that he was defensive or reactive to the material. He was very, very engaged in the conversation, had questions, had this, had that. And so I felt like that was a really significant validator for having chosen the right path in this particular situation.
Yeah.
Awesome. That's
great. Just incredible.
We are family.
Jamie, what are you doing?
I got all my sisters.
Why are you singing? Oh my God.
We are family.
I know what she's doing, you guys. She's introducing the new podcast, We Are Family, to our listeners, of course. She's so weird. But we really do need to share this new podcast with everyone, because they're going to love it.
I know. Listen, if they love our podcast, they're going to love this one. It's about the modern family, which we all know about. And the hosts are celebrity fitness entrepreneur and friend of ours, outspoken LGBTQ parent, Shanti, and Parents Magazine editor, who is going to be a future friend of ours, I feel like.
Yes, for sure.
Julia Dennison.
Julia! Yeah, you're going to want to join each week as they talk with experts and parents, celeb and civilian alike, about today's hottest parenting topics like IVF and fertility science, surrogacy, fostering and adoption, blended families, divorce, LGBTQ parenting, and cultural differences.
Like the gamut. Come on now. They run the gamut. It's a perfect podcast for our perfect listeners. You see what I did there?
I see what you did.
See? Listen to We Are Family on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. We
Shanti,
are family.
Julia.
Yeah, we are. So you're doing trainings now. It's happening.
Yeah. So we've designed three trainings, and I like workshop style so that we could stop and converse. This is not something that you can, that everyone can just read and get and move on with their day. Like to really get distance from stigma and make new associations, that conversation piece is so important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The first one is very much a 101, which is really just creating the relevancy and the foundation around why we're doing this work to develop buy-in. And then just some real basic, like, here are common assumptions, here are common language changes that we need to make. The second training is trans inclusion and non-binary inclusion, and the specific struggles that someone who's gender nonconforming might experience.
I think it was much informed around a lot of the pieces that I'd gone through in a clinic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The use of the proper name, use of proper pronouns, because you've never, apart from our doctor, your proper name has never been called and used in the clinic, ever.
Yeah, and they have a system in order to identify chosen names or the names that people go by. And they put in bracket the name that you're supposed to be referred to. Mine has always showed up in brackets. They've only ever gone to the very first name, paid zero attention to the rest, and have always called out my legal name, which never once in my life have I ever gone by.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. So in the workshop, when we were talking about that, it kind of came out that their practice is to only look at brackets if there's a racialized name that they don't feel they can pronounce.
So, which is a whole other level of problem.
Yeah. And like there's
that's a whole, that oh my God.
The system that also has a racist element to it that we need to address.
Oh my God.
Yeah. The fact that you're so casual about this disclosure means you've never thought about it, which means that you are like knees deep in racism that you have never even considered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the trans and non-binary inclusion training, we drew in pieces from our own story. We also use, there's a lot of material, research and surveys now around trans health and trans access to fertility clinics. We drew that in. And then there's, again, a lot of great videos from trans and non-binary folks talking about their experience of accessing fertility clinics, but also what it's like for a span of people from that community to be pregnant. So we really tried to highlight a lot of voices, not just our own. And then, of course, offering affirming practices and what you can do to mitigate those barriers within medical culture and to support someone in their experience of being pregnant. And then the third training is trauma-aware care. So that's one where we'll share more about our experiences with the clinic and go over with them what care that takes into account that someone might be experiencing distress during the procedure actually looks like. So those are the three that we're doing right now. And in between, we share material so they can have continuing education options in between.
Okay. It's important. Really important.
Now you've done all this change, but where are you now in the baby process?
So we're down to like 8 embryos now. So with the second round, we had our first one not take. Our second one resulted in a second miscarriage. And then we paused at that point because it had been years at this point in time of being on like mega hormones for an exceptionally long period of time. And it was super, super rough on the body.
Yeah, I found that. So yeah, I had gained weight and that in itself is not a problem. But the way that my body felt in this weight was very different than any other time in my life where I had gained weight. So my joints felt really weak and I felt like I had lost muscle integrity and like, I don't know if that's a part of the being on those hormones for so long, but I had been on those hormones for like 3-5 years. Like it's a long time to be on hormones that you're not supposed to be on. So I had alluded to that other relationship being a bad one. It was an abusive relationship and I had PTSD immediately after I left. And our last miscarriage was December 23rd, just before Christmas, this past Christmas. And at that point, I was starting to feel my body react to medical procedures, similar to the way that it was reacting when I had had active PTSD years ago. So I wasn't having a lot of the emotional symptoms of PTSD, but in a medical setting, it didn't matter if it was a needle or an exam or something invasive or not invasive. I would freeze, I would start to shake, I would start to cry. And I was like, my body is screaming that it can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
So our doctor had recommended that both Gab and I go to a clinic to get a test done to see if there's anything going on with my uterus that is preventing a viable pregnancy and anything going on with Gab so that we could decide if we're going to keep moving with me or consider Gab as a carrier. And look at her face. She'll have something to say about this in a moment. But I was really scared of this procedure because I was like, my body's freaking out and I want to have this procedure because I myself and my brain want to know if I should continue doing this or not, but my body really doesn't want to do it. So I called the clinic and I told them like, look, I have this procedure coming up in a few weeks. I've lived through violence. I've had PTSD and I'm starting to feel it come up. That's all I said so far. And they said, okay, we're going to schedule you a separate phone call so that we could go over everything with you and you can decide if you want to do this or not. And it was amazing. So they,
that is amazing.
We had another phone call. I had done a lot of therapy, and I feel that I have a good amount of awareness of what helps me cope. You're never the full expert on yourself, of course, but I feel like I know what helps me in those moments. So I let them know all the things that help me in procedures in their consent form. I've never seen a consent form like this before. They have a clause that says, if at any point during a procedure you need the practitioner to stop, please say no, and we will immediately stop. If you need a support person, talk to us about it. It's really important that your safety in the procedure is respected. I've never seen a clause like that before.
Yeah, wow.
And then I called my doctor, our fertility doctor, and I told him about this, let him know what was going on. And he said, he's like, Amanda, even if you need to cancel the morning of, you can cancel the morning of. Like, it's going to be okay. I felt so much more calm about doing a procedure. So I was able to do it, and it was a great, I've never walked away from like an invasive procedure being like, that was a pleasant experience, but they did such a good job. They did amazing. It was awesome.
Yeah.
But, and then the pandemic hit, and our clinic shut down for a while, and they're partially running at this point. And I was relieved actually that the pandemic prevented us from the choice of trying, because it didn't mean that I had to decide not to.
So you guys are paused at this point.
Yeah, we're paused. But our doctor contacted us and said that we have the option of trying as early as next month. The thought of going back to the procedures, I'm not sure that my body's ready again. And I still feel a bit of panic arise when I think about going back to it. I'm not sure that I will. And that's one of the things that I'm like, Jamie, we had been talking about earlier, that in all of the stories and all of the support groups and all of the materials I found about making families as a queer couple, I haven't found many, if any, where the story is, I tried and tried and tried and nothing happened. Like, everybody has, and it was worth it because it worked in the end, and it was worth it because this and that. But I'm like, am I going to be the person that whose story is nothing happened?
That's tough.
Yeah. Really hard.
Yeah. I mean, you guys are in it's complicated.
You're in the thick of it. You know, it's like we talk all the time about it's this roller coaster, and you're strapped in and you can't get off. And you've gone too far and you don't want to change directions, and then you don't want to lose more time. And then it just keeps building and building. And it's like, how, you know, I keep thinking about that thing you said, Amanda, earlier about someone saying to you, well, can't you just like stop trying and then it'll happen for you? It's like, we don't have that. And your body, the stress within your body is ratcheting up and up and up and up and up, which makes it probably, I mean, I'm not a doctor, for God's sakes, and everybody knows that, but like probably less likely to happen because of the stress. And what can we do about that? You know, we're told like try acupuncture, meditate, but we have no resources. And I just really feel for you two being in this position.
Yeah. And I think that there's like another piece of this too, where I think that it's really hard for everybody outside of you to just sit with your grief. Because at the end of the day, the reality is some people just can't get pregnant or don't get pregnant. And that's just a biological fact. But I think that is like, we have such a heightened expectation in society that like, we will get there, that everybody wants to be your cheerleader, but nobody wants to be the person to accept that that also might not happen. And how do we just sit with each other through that period of grief? And that's another story, right?
Yeah.
There's grief to it. But the fact that there's grief doesn't mean that I'm not okay with it, you know? And I think that's something that people kind of lump in. If you're feeling sad, it's something that you're going to suffer with for forever. And I'm like, at this point, I don't think that I'll suffer. If we don't have family through our bodies, I don't think I'll suffer in life because of it. But I will have grief that I've never had the experience of pregnancy and labor. And I know so many people are going to be like, what the fuck is she talking about? But whatever that experience would be, I really did want to have that experience. So I will grieve it, but I can also have acceptance.
Mm-hmm. I think just from speaking with you guys for this little amount of time we've been speaking, I know that whatever decision you make, it's going to be well thought out and it's going to be the right decision for you. Whatever outcome you have, it's going to be a good outcome for you.
It'll be okay. Mm-hmm. I think you guys are changing people's lives, like from the work that you're doing with the clinic, but also just sharing the story. And I'm so thankful. I said it before that I'll say it again, that you reached out so that we could share this with many, many people need to hear your story. And I'm so glad reached out.
Thanks for making time for us.
Are you kidding me?
Oh God, of course. Are you kidding? But also, you know, we're invested, as Robin loves to say, we are fully invested in your journey. So if you have any updates, please let us know if you want to share them with us, you know. We want to know. We want to know what you finally decide. And we are in your court no matter what.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
We are so happy to share the story.
Ooh, that was intense.
It was.
I cried several times.
They did good stuff, though.
I know they did. They're just like, they're like powerhouses. I just kept thinking about, like, how can they take what they did at that one clinic and how can they... How can we make that a blueprint for other clinics so other people don't have to live through those microaggressions?
I know, because they're there.
I don't know how to do that, though.
They're out there. They're just out there.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm so impressed with how they didn't just take it. You know what I mean? That they just were like, fuck this shit.
And they have full-time jobs.
Oh, my God. It's amazing.
People find strength in so many ways. Yeah,
they were wonderful.
Anyway.
All right. Well, we're as sad as we are to say goodbye for our final episode of the season. Just 5 weeks.
Oh, guys.
We just some couple things we'll say to you before we go.
Yes. Go ahead.
You can buy our book and you can pre-order our book right now through Amazon. It's going to be available on September 22nd, but you can in the Kindle edition, print, hardcover, and audiobook.
All major retailers, it will be available at, which is exciting.
Correct.
Guys, join us on the social. We are there. We will be there through the break.
Yeah, we'll be active.
You won't be without us. You can get us on Ovaries Talk on Twitter. Ovaries_talk on Insta. If these ovaries could talk on Facebook, you can also join our private community there and talk to other listeners. Mm-hmm. And you can join our community on Patreon at patreon.com/ovariestalk for bonus content, unedited videos, all the stuff.
And to help support our podcast.
Please do. We appreciate it. And you can also now subscribe to us on YouTube to catch up on our Ovaries Talk live streams, which why haven't you watched them?
Come on now. We're getting good guests there.
We do. We bring guests on. We have a straight ally segment.
Yeah.
We need a break. We love you guys.
We'll see you September 7th.
Yes.
And thank you to our sponsors, BetterHelp, and the new podcast, We Are Family, for helping to make this show possible. We thank you.
We thank you so much. We thank you all. Thank you for listening. We'll see you soon.
Okay. Eggs,
ovaries.
Take a break.
Out.
If these ovaries could talk, they would say, eggs, ovaries, out.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.